The shortwave transmitter had been set up in the large crypt beneath the chateau, with three skilled operators in attendance, working in shifts, and he, Count Barsac, in charge of the entire operation as guardian angel. Rather, as guardian demon. "There is a graveyard on the hillside below," he informed them. "A humble resting place for poor and ignorant people. It contains a single imposing crypt, the ancestral tomb of the Barsacs. We shall open that crypt, remove the remains of the last count, and allow the villagers to discover that the coffin is empty. They will never dare come near the spot or the chateau again, because this will prove that the legend is true. Count Barsac is a vampire, and walks once more." The question came then, what if there are skeptics? What if someone does not believe? And he had his answer ready. "They will believe, for at night, I shall walk. I, Count Barsac." After they saw him in the makeup, wearing the black cloak, there were no more questions. The role was his. The role was his, and he'd played it well. The Count nodded to himself as he climbed the stairs and entered the roofless foyer of the chateau, where only a configuration of cobwebs veiled the radiance of the rising moon. Now, of course, the curtain must come down. If the American advance had swept past the village below, it was time to make one's bow and exit. And that, too, had been well arranged. During the German withdrawal, another advantageous use had been made of the tomb in the graveyard. A cache of Air Marshal Goering's art treasures now rested safely and undisturbed within the crypt. A truck had been placed in the chateau. Even now, the three wireless operators would be playing new parts, driving the truck down the hillside to the tomb, placing the objet d'art in it. By the time the Count arrived there, everything would be packed. They would then don the stolen American Army uniforms, carry the forged identifications and permits, drive through the lines across the river, and rejoin the German forces at a pre-designated spot. Nothing had been left to chance. Someday, when he wrote his memoirs... But there was not time to consider that now. The Count glanced up through the gaping aperture in the ruined roof. The moon was high. It was time to leave. In a way, he hated to go. Where others saw only dust and cobwebs, he saw a stage, the setting of his finest performance. Playing a vampire's role had not addicted him to the taste of blood, but as an actor, he enjoyed the taste of triumph, and he had triumphed here. "Parting is such sweet sorrow." Shakespeare's line. Shakespeare, who had written of ghosts and witches, of bloody apparitions. Because Shakespeare knew that his audiences, the stupid masses, believed in such things, just as they still believed today. A great actor could always make them believe. The Count moved into the shadowy darkness outside the entrance of the chateau. He started down the pathway toward the beckoning trees. It was here, amid the trees, that he had come upon Raymond, one evening weeks ago. Raymond had been his most appreciative audience. A stern, dignified, white-haired elderly man, mayor of the village of Barsac. But there had been nothing dignified about the old fool when he'd caught sight of the Count looming up before him out of the night. He'd screamed like a woman and run. Probably Raymond had been prowling around, intent on poaching, but all that had been forgotten after his encounter in the woods. The mayor was the one to thank for spreading the rumors that the Count was again abroad. He and Claudet, the oafish miller, had then led an armed band to the graveyard and entered the Barsac tomb. What a fright they got when they discovered the Count's coffin open and empty. The coffin had contained only dust that had been scattered to the winds, but they could not know that, nor could they know about what had happened to Suzanne. The Count was passing the banks of a small stream now. Here, on another evening, he'd found the girl, Raymond's daughter, as luck would have it, in an embrace with young Antoine Lefebvre, her lover. Antoine's shattered leg had invalided him out of the army, but he ran like a deer when he glimpsed the cloak masked and grinning count. Suzanne had been left behind, and that was unfortunate, because it was necessary to dispose of her. Her body had been buried in the woods, beneath great stones, and there was no question of discovery. Still, it was a regrettable incident. In the end, however, everything was for the best. Now silly, superstitious Raymond was doubly convinced that the vampire walked. He had seen the creature himself, had seen the empty tomb and the open coffin. His own daughter had disappeared. At his command, none dared venture near the graveyard, the woods, or the chateau beyond. Poor Raymond. He was not even a mayor anymore. His village had been destroyed in the bombardment. Just an ignorant, broken old man, mumbling his idiotic nonsense about the living dead. The Count smiled and walked on, his cloak fluttering in the breeze, casting a bat-like shadow on the pathway before him. He could see the graveyard now, the tilted tombstones rising from the earth like leprous fingers rotting in the moonlight. His smile faded. He did not like such thoughts. Perhaps the greatest tribute to his talent as an actor lay in his actual aversion to death, to darkness, and what lurked in the night. He hated the sight of blood, had developed within himself an almost claustrophobic dread of the confinement of the crypt. Yes, it had been a great role, but he was thankful it was ending. It would be good to play the man once more, and cast off the creature he had created. As he approached the crypt, he saw the truck waiting in the shadows. The entrance to the tomb was open, but no sounds issued from it. That meant his colleagues had completed their task of loading and were ready to go. All that remained now was to change his clothing, remove the makeup, and depart. The Count moved to the darkened truck, and then they were upon him, and he felt the tines of the pitchfork bite into his back, and as the flash of lanterns dazzled his eyes, he heard the stern command, "Don't move." He didn't move. He could only stare as they surrounded him. Antoine, Claudet, Raymond, and the others. A dozen peasants from the village. A dozen armed peasants, glaring at him in mingled rage and fear, holding him at bay. But how could they dare? The American corporal stepped forward. That was the answer, of course. The American corporal and another man in uniform, armed with a sniper's rifle. They were responsible. He didn't even have to see the riddled corpses of the three shortwave operators piled in the back of the truck to understand what had happened. They'd stumbled on his men while they worked, shot them down, then summoned the villagers. Now they were jabbering questions at him, in English, of course. He understood English, but he knew better than to reply. "Who are you? Were these men working under your orders? Where were you going with this truck?" The Count smiled and shook his head. After a while, they stopped, as he knew they would. The corporal turned to his companion. "Okay," he said. "Let's go." The other man nodded and climbed into the cab of the truck as the motor coughed into life. The corporal moved to join him, then turned to Raymond. "We're taking this across the river," he said. "Hang on to our friend here. They'll be sending a guard detail for him within an hour." Raymond nodded. The truck drove off into the darkness. And it was dark now. The moon had vanished behind a cloud. The Count's smile vanished too, as he glanced around at his captors. A rabble of stupid clods, surly and ignorant, but armed, no chance of escaping. And they kept staring at him and mumbling, "Take him into the tomb." It was Raymond who spoke, and they obeyed, prodding their captive forward with pitchforks. That was when the Count recognized the first faint ray of hope, for they prodded him most gingerly, no man coming close, and when he glared at them, their eyes dropped. They were putting him in the crypt because they were afraid of him. Now the Americans were gone, they feared him once more, feared his presence and his power. After all, in their eyes, he was a vampire. He might turn into a bat and vanish entirely. So they wanted him in the tomb for safekeeping. The Count shrugged smiled his most sinister smile, and bared his teeth. They shrank back as he entered the doorway. He turned and, on impulse, furled his cape. It was an instinctive final gesture, in keeping with his role, and it provoked the appropriate response. They moaned, and old Raymond crossed himself. It was better, in a way, than any applause. In the darkness of the crypt, the Count permitted himself to relax a trifle. He was off stage now. A pity he'd not been able to make his exit the way he'd planned, but such were the fortunes of war. Soon he'd be taken to the American headquarters and interrogated. Undoubtedly there would be some unpleasant moments, but the worst that could befall him was a few months in a prison camp. And even the Americans must bow to him in appreciation when they heard the story of his masterful deception. It was dark in the crypt, and musty. The Count moved about restlessly. His knee grazed the edge of the empty coffin set on a trestle in the tomb. He shuddered involuntarily, loosening his cape at the throat. It would be good to remove it, good to be out of here, good to shed the role of vampire forever. He'd played it well, but now he was anxious to be gone. There was a mumbling audible from outside, mingled with another and less identifiable noise, a scraping sound. The Count moved to the closed door of the crypt and listened intently, but now there was only silence. What were the fools doing out there? He wished the Americans would hurry back. It was too hot in here. And why the sudden silence? Perhaps they'd gone. Yes, that was it. The Americans had told them to wait and guard him, but they were afraid. They really believed he was a vampire. Old Raymond had convinced them of that. So they'd run off. They'd run off, and he was free. He could escape now. So the Count opened the door. And he saw them then, saw them standing and waiting, old Raymond staring sternly for a moment before he moved forward. He was holding something in his hand, and the Count recognized it, remembering the scraping sound that he'd heard. It was a long wooden stake with a sharp point. Then he opened his mouth to scream, telling them it was only a trick. He was no vampire. They were a pack of superstitious fools. But all the while they bore him back into the crypt, lifting him up and thrusting him into the open coffin, holding him there as the grim-faced Raymond raised the pointed stake above his heart. It was only when the stake came down that he realized there's such a thing as playing a role too well.
Down Among the Dead Men by Gardner Dozois and Jack Dan. Gardner Dozois, born in 1947, grew up in Salem, Massachusetts, and following service in the Army, became active in the science fiction and fantasy community. He was the editor of Isaac Asimov's science fiction magazine from 1984 to 2004, winning an astounding 15 Hugo Awards as Best Professional Editor. He has also edited the year's Best Science Fiction annually since 1984. With Jack Dan, he has edited many single-subject anthologies with such themes as unicorns, mermaids, dinosaurs, angels, and cats. Dozois also writes novels, including Strangers, 1978, and Nightmare Blue, 1977, in collaboration with George Alec Effinger. Two of his many short stories have won Nebula Awards. Jack Dan, born in 1945, an American author living in Australia, has written or edited more than 70 books in various genres that have been translated into 13 languages, and has been compared with Jorge Luis Borges, Roald Dahl, Lewis Carroll, and Mark Twain, while winning numerous awards, including a Nebula, the Australian Aurealis, twice, and World Fantasy. He has written a historical novel about Leonardo da Vinci, The Memory Cathedral, 1995. A Civil War novel, The Silent, 1998. A road novel, Bad Medicine, 2001, described as the best since Jack Kerouac's On the Road. The Rebel, An Imagined Life of James Dean, 2004. And a sequel, Promised Land, 2007. Down Among the Dead Men was first published in We magazine in July 1982.
Down Among the Dead Men by Gardner Dozois and Jack Dan. Read by Bob Walter. Bruckmann first discovered that Wernicke was a vampire when they went to the quarry that morning. He was bending down to pick up a large rock when he thought he heard something in the gully nearby. He looked around and saw Wernicke huddled over a Musselmann, one of the walking dead, a new man who had not been able to wake up to the terrible reality of the camp.
"Do you need any help?"
Bruckmann asked Wernicke in a low voice. Wernicke looked up startled and covered his mouth with his hand, as if he were signing to Bruckmann to be quiet. But Bruckmann was certain that he had glimpsed blood smeared on Wernicke's mouth.
"The Musselmann, is he alive?"
Wernicke had often risked his own life to save one or another of the men in his barracks, but to risk one's life for a Musselmann...
"What's wrong? Get away."
"All right," Bruckmann thought. "Best to leave him alone." He looked pale. Perhaps it was typhus. The guards were working him hard enough, and Wernicke was older than the rest of the men in the work gang. Let him sit for a moment and rest. But what about that blood?
"Hey, you! What are you doing?"
one of the young SS guards shouted to Bruckmann. Bruckmann picked up the rock and, as if he had not heard the guard, began to walk away from the gully toward the rusty brown cart on the tracks that led back to the barbed wire fence of the camp. He would try to draw the guard's attention away from Wernicke. But the guard shouted at him to halt.
"Are you taking a little rest? Is that it?"
he asked, and Bruckmann tensed, ready for a beating. This guard was new, neatly and cleanly dressed, and an unknown quantity. He walked over to the gully, and seeing Wernicke and the Musselmann, said,
"Aha! So your friend is taking care of the sick."
He motioned Bruckmann to follow him into the gully. Bruckmann had done the unpardonable. He had brought it on Wernicke. He swore at himself. He had been in this camp long enough to know to keep his mouth shut. The guard kicked Wernicke sharply in the ribs.
"I want you to put the Musselmann in the cart, now."
He kicked Wernicke again, as if as an afterthought. Wernicke groaned but got to his feet.
"Help him put the Musselmann in the cart,"
the guard said to Bruckmann. Then he smiled and drew a circle in the air, the sign of smoke, the smoke which rose from the tall gray chimneys behind them. This Musselmann would be in the oven within an hour, his ashes soon to be floating in the hot, stale air, as if they were the very particles of his soul. Wernicke kicked the Musselmann, and the guard chuckled, waved to another guard who had been watching, and stepped back a few feet. He stood with his hands on his hips.
"Come on, dead man, get up, or you're going to die in the oven,"
Wernicke whispered as he tried to pull the man to his feet. Bruckmann supported the unsteady Musselmann, who began to wail softly. Wernicke slapped him hard.
"Do you want to live, Musselmann? Do you want to see your family again? Feel the touch of a woman, smell grass after it's been mowed, then move."
The Musselmann shambled forward between Wernicke and Bruckmann.
"You're dead, aren't you, Musselmann?" goaded Wernicke. "As dead as your father and mother, as dead as your sweet wife, if you ever had one, aren't you? Dead!"
The Musselmann groaned, shook his head, and whispered,
"Not dead. My wife."
"Ah, it talks," Wernicke said, loud enough so the guard walking a step behind them could hear. "Do you have a name, corpse?"
"Josef, and I'm not a Musselmann."
"The corpse says he's alive," Wernicke said, again loud enough for the SS guard to hear. Then, in a whisper, he said,
"Josef, if you're not a Musselmann, then you must work now, do you understand?"
Josef tripped, and Bruckmann caught him.
"Let him be," said Wernicke. "Let him walk to the cart himself." "Not the cart,"
Josef mumbled.
"Not to die. Not. Then get down and pick up stones. Show the fart-eating god you can work." "Can't. I'm sick. I'm
Musselmann."
Josef bent down, fell to his knees, but took hold of a stone and stood up.
"You see," Wernicke said to the guard, "it's not dead yet.
It can still work.
I told you to carry him to the cart, didn't I?
The guard said petulantly.
Show him you can work,
Wernicke said to Josef, or you'll surely be smoke. And Josef stumbled away from Wernicke and Bruckmann, leaning forward as if following the rock he was carrying.
Bring him back!
Shouted the guard, but his attention was distracted from Josef by some other prisoners who, sensing the trouble, began to mill about. One of the other guards began to shout and kick at the men on the periphery, and the new guard joined him. For the moment, he had forgotten about Josef.
Let's get to work, lest they notice us again, Wernicke said.
I'm sorry that I...
Wernicke laughed and made a fluttering gesture with his hand, smoke rising.
It's all hazard, my friend, all luck.
Again the laugh.
It was a venial sin,
and his face seemed to darken.
Never do it again, though, lest I think of you as bad luck.
Karl, are you all right?
Bruckmann asked.
I noticed some blood when...
Do the sores on your feet bleed in the morning?
Wernicke countered angrily. Bruckmann nodded, feeling foolish and embarrassed.
And so it is with my gums. Now go away, unlucky one, and let me live.
At dusk, the guards broke the hypnosis of lifting and grunting and sweating, and formed the prisoners into ranks. They marched back to the camp through the fields, beside the railroad tracks, the electrified wire, conical towers, and into the main gate of the camp. Josef walked beside them, but he kept stumbling as he was once again slipping back into death, becoming a Musulman. Wernicke helped him walk, pushed him along.
We should let this man become dead, Wernicke said to Bruckmann.
Bruckmann only nodded, but he felt a chill sweep over his sweating back. He was seeing Wernicke's face again as it was for that instant in the morning, smeared with blood. Yes, Bruckmann thought, we should let the Musulman become dead. We should all be dead. Wernicke served up the lukewarm water with bits of spoiled turnip floating on the top, what passed as soup for the prisoners. Everyone sat or kneeled on the rough planked floor, as there were no chairs. Bruckmann ate his portion, counting the sips and bites, forcing himself to take his time. Later, he would take a very small bite of the bread he had in his pocket. He always saved a small morsel of food for later. In the endless world of the camp, he had learned to give himself things to look forward to. Better to dream of bread than to get lost in the present. That was the fate of the Musulmänner. But he always dreamed of food. Hunger was with him every moment of the day and night. Those times when he actually ate were, in a way, the most difficult, for there was never enough to satisfy him. There was the taste of softness in his mouth, and then, in an instant, it was gone. The emptiness took the form of pain. It hurt to eat. For bread, he thought, he would have killed his father or his wife. God forgive me. And he watched Wernicke. Wernicke, who had shared his bread with him, who had died a little so he could live. He's a better man than I, Bruckmann thought. It was dim inside the barracks. A bare light bulb hung from the ceiling and cast sharp shadows across the cavernous room. Two tiers of 5-foot-deep shelves ran around the room on three sides, bare wooden shelves where the men slept without blankets or mattresses. Set high in the northern wall was a slatted window which let in the stark white light of the Kliegs. Outside, the lights turned the grounds into a deathly imitation of day. Only inside the barracks was it night.
"Do you know what tonight is, my friends?"
Wernicke asked. He sat in the far corner of the room with Josef, who, hour by hour, was reverting back into a Musulman. Wernicke's face looked hollow and drawn in the light from the window and the light bulb. His eyes were deep-set, and his face was long with deep creases running from his nose to the corners of his thin mouth. His hair was black, and even since Bruckmann had known him, quite a bit of it had fallen out. He was a very tall man, almost 6'4", and that made him stand out in a crowd, which was dangerous in a death camp. But Wernicke had his own secret ways of blending with the crowd, of making himself invisible.
"No, tell us what tonight is,"
crazy old Boma said. That men such as Boma could survive was a miracle, or, as Bruckmann thought, a testament to men such as Wernicke, who somehow found the strength to help the others live.
"It's Passover," Wernicke said.
"How does he know that?" someone mumbled, but it didn't matter how Wernicke knew, because he knew, even if it really wasn't Passover by the calendar. In this dimly lit barrack it was Passover, the Feast of Freedom, the time of Thanksgiving.
"But how can we have Passover without a Seder?"
asked Boma.
"We don't even have any matzo,"
he whined.
"Nor do we have candles, or a silver cup for Elijah, or the shank bone, or haroset. Nor would I make a seder over the treif the Nazis are so generous in giving us," replied Wernicke with a smile. "But we can pray, can't we? And when we all get out of here, when we are in our homes in the coming year with God's help, then we'll have twice as much food, 2 afikomens, a bottle of wine for Elijah, and the Haggadahs that our fathers and our fathers' fathers used."
It was Passover.
"Isidore, do you remember the 4 questions?" Wernicke asked Bruckmann. And Bruckmann heard himself speaking.
He was 12 years old again at the long table beside his father, who sat in the seat of honor. To sit next to him was itself an honor.
"How does this night differ from all other nights? On all other nights we eat bread and matzo. Why on this night do we eat only matzo?" Ma nishtana laila hazeh.
Sleep would not come to Bruckmann that night, although he was so tired that he felt as if the marrow of his bones had been sucked away and replaced with lead. He lay there in the semi-darkness, feeling his muscles ache, feeling the acid biting of his hunger. Usually he was numb enough with exhaustion that he could empty his mind, close himself down, and fall rapidly into oblivion. But not tonight. Tonight he was noticing things again. His surroundings were getting through to him again in a way that they had not since he had been new in camp. It was smotheringly hot, and the air was filled with the stinks of death and sweat and fever, of stale urine and drying blood. The sleepers thrashed and turned as though they fought with sleep, and as they slept, many of them talked or muttered or screamed aloud. They lived other lives in their dreams, intensely compressed lives dreamed quickly, for soon it would be dawn, and once more they would be thrust into hell. Cramped in the midst of them, sleepers squeezed in all around him, it suddenly seemed to Bruckmann that these pallid white bodies were already dead, that he was sleeping in a graveyard. Suddenly it was the boxcar again, and his wife Miriam was dead again, dead and rotting, unburied. Resolutely, Bruckmann emptied his mind. He felt feverish and shaky, and wondered if the typhus were coming back, but he couldn't afford to worry about it. Those who couldn't sleep couldn't survive. Regulate your breathing. Force your muscles to relax. Don't think. Don't think. For some reason, after he had managed to banish even the memory of his dead wife, he couldn't shake the image of the blood on Wernicke's mouth. There were other images mixed in with it. Wernicke's uplifted arms and upturned face as he led them in prayer, the pale, strained face of the stumbling Musulman, Wernicke looking up, startled as he crouched over Yosef. But it was the blood to which Bruckmann's feverish thoughts returned, and he pictured it again and again as he lay in the rustling, fart-smelling darkness, the watery sheen of blood over Wernicke's lips, the tarry trickle of blood in the corner of his mouth, like a tiny scarlet worm. Just then a shadow crossed in front of the window, silhouetted blackly for an instant against the harsh white glare, and Bruckmann knew from the shadow's height and its curious forward stoop that it was Wernicke.
Where could he be going? Sometimes a prisoner would be unable to wait until morning, when the Germans would let them out to visit the slit trench latrine again, and would slink shamefacedly into a far corner to piss against a wall. But surely Wernicke was too much of an old hand for that. Most of the prisoners slept on the sleeping platforms, especially during the cold nights when they would huddle together for warmth. But sometimes, during the hot weather, people would drift away and sleep on the floor instead. Brookmann had been thinking of doing that, as the jostling bodies of the sleepers around him helped to keep him from sleep. Perhaps Wernicke, who always had trouble fitting into the cramped sleeping niches, was merely looking for a place where he could lie down and stretch his legs. Then Brookmann remembered that Josef had fallen asleep in the corner of the room where Wernicke had sat and prayed, and that they had left him there alone. Without knowing why, Brookmann found himself on his feet. As silently as the ghost he sometimes felt he was becoming, he walked across the room in the direction Wernicke had gone, not understanding what he was doing nor why he was doing it. The face of the Mussulman, Josef, seemed to float behind his eyes. Brookmann's feet hurt, and he knew without looking that they were bleeding, leaving faint tracks behind him. It was dimmer here in the far corner away from the window, but Brookmann knew that he must be near the wall by now, and he stopped to let his eyes readjust. When his eyes had adapted to the dimmer light, he saw Josef sitting on the floor, propped up against the wall. Wernicke was hunched over the Mussulman, kissing him. One of Josef's hands was tangled in Wernicke's thinning hair. Before Brookmann could react, such things had been known to happen once or twice before, although it shocked him deeply that Wernicke would be involved in such filth, Josef released his grip on Wernicke's hair. Josef's upraised arm fell limply to the side, his hand hitting the floor with a muffled but solid impact that should have been painful. But Josef made no sound. Wernicke straightened up and turned around. Stronger light from the high window caught him as he straightened to his full height, momentarily illuminating his face. Wernicke's mouth was smeared with blood.
"My God!"
Brookmann cried. Startled, Wernicke flinched, then took two quick steps forward and seized Brookmann by the arm.
"Quiet,"
Wernicke hissed. His fingers were cold and hard. At that moment, as though Wernicke's sudden movement were a cue, Josef began to slip down sideways along the wall. As Wernicke and Brookmann watched, both momentarily riveted by the sight, Josef toppled over to the floor, his head striking against the floorboards, with a sound such as a dropped melon might make. He had made no attempt to break his fall or cushion his head, and lay now, unmoving.
"My God!"
Brookmann said again.
"Quiet. I'll explain,"
Wernicke said, his lips still glazed with the Mussulman blood.
"Do you want to ruin us all? For the love of God, be quiet."
But Brookmann had shaken free of Wernicke's grip and crossed to kneel by Josef, leaning over him as Wernicke had done, placing a hand flat on Josef's chest for a moment, then touching the side of Josef's neck. Brookmann looked slowly up at Wernicke.
"He's dead,"
Brookmann said more quietly. Wernicke squatted on the other side of Josef's body, and the rest of their conversation was carried out in whispers over Josef's chest, like friends conversing at the sickbed of another friend who has finally fallen into a fitful doze.
"Yes, he's dead," Wernicke said. "He was dead yesterday, wasn't he? Today, he had just stopped walking."
His eyes were hidden here in the deeper shadow, nearer to the floor, but there was still enough light for Brookmann to see that Wernicke had wiped his lips clean, or licked them clean, Brookmann thought, and felt a spasm of nausea go through him.
"But you,"
Brookmann said haltingly,
"you were..."
"Drinking his blood?" Wernicke said. "Yes, I was drinking his blood."
Brookmann's mind was numb. He couldn't deal with this. He couldn't understand it at all.
"But why, Edward? Why?"
"To live, of course."
Why do any of us do anything here? If I am to live, I must have blood. Without it, I'd face a death even more certain than that doled out by the Nazis.
Bruckmann opened and closed his mouth, but no sound came out, as if the words he wished to speak were too jagged to fit through his throat. At last he managed to croak,
"A vampire? You're a vampire? Like in the old stories?"
Wernicke said calmly,
"Men would call me that."
He paused, then nodded.
"Yes, that's what men would call me, as though they can understand something simply by giving it a name."
"But Edward,"
Bruckmann said weakly, almost petulantly,
"the Musulman." "Remember that he was a Musulman,"
Wernicke said, leaning forward and speaking more fiercely. "His strength was going. He was sinking.
He would have been dead by morning anyway. I took from him something that he no longer needed, but that I needed in order to live. Does it matter? Starving men in lifeboats have eaten the bodies of their dead companions in order to live. Is what I have done any worse than that?"
"But he didn't just die. You killed him."
Wernicke was silent for a moment, and then said quietly,
"What better thing could I have done for him? I won't apologize for what I do, Isidore. I do what I have to do to live. Usually I take only a little blood from a number of men, just enough to survive. And that's fair, isn't it? Haven't I given food to others to help them survive? To you, Isidore. Only very rarely do I take more than a minimum from any one man, although I am weak and hungry all the time, believe me. And never have I drained the life from someone who wished to live. Instead, I've helped them fight for survival in every way I can. You know that."
He reached out as though to touch Bruckmann, then thought better of it and put his hand back on his own knee. He shook his head.
"But these Musulmen, the ones who have given up on life, the walking dead, it is a favor to them to take them, to give them the solace of death. Can you honestly say it is not here? That it is better for them to walk around while they are dead, being beaten and abused by the Nazis, until their bodies cannot go on, and then to be thrown into the ovens like trash? Can you say that? Would they say that if they knew what was going on? Or would they thank me?"
Wernicke suddenly stood up, and Bruckmann stood up with him. As Wernicke's face came again into the stronger light, Bruckmann could see that his eyes had filled with tears.
"You have lived under the Nazis," Wernicke said. "Can you really call me a monster? Aren't I still a Jew, whatever else I might be? Aren't I here in a death camp? Aren't I being persecuted too, as much as any other? Aren't I in as much danger as anyone else? If I'm not a Jew, then tell the Nazis. They seem to think so."
He paused for a moment and then smiled wryly.
"And forget your superstitious boogie tales. I'm no night spirit. If I could turn myself into a bat and fly away from here, I would have done it long before now. Believe me."
Bruckmann smiled reflectively, then grimaced. The two men avoided each other's eyes, Bruckmann looking at the floor, and there was an uneasy silence punctured only by the sighing and moaning of the sleepers on the other side of the cabin. Then, without looking up, in tacit surrender, Bruckmann said,
"What about him? The Nazis will find the body and cause trouble."
"Don't worry,"
Wernicke said. "There are no obvious marks, and nobody performs autopsies in a death camp. To the Nazis,
He'll be just another Jew who had died of the heat, or from starvation, or sickness, or from a broken heart. Bruckmann raised his head then, and they stared eye to eye for a moment. Even knowing what he knew, Bruckmann found it hard to see Wernicke as anything other than what he appeared to be, an aging, balding Jew, stooping and thin, with sad eyes and a tired, compassionate face.
"Well, then, Isidore,"
Wernicke said at last, matter-of-factly,
"my life is in your hands. I will not be indelicate enough to remind you of how many times your life has been in mine."
Then he was gone, walking back toward the sleeping platforms, a shadow soon lost among other shadows. Bruckmann stood by himself in the gloom for a long time, and then followed him. It took all of his will not to look back over his shoulder at the corner where Josef lay, and even so Bruckmann imagined that he could feel Josef's dead eyes watching him, watching reproachfully as he walked away, abandoning Josef to the cold and isolated company of the dead. Bruckmann got no more sleep that night, and in the morning when the Nazis shattered the gray pre-dawn stillness by bursting into the shack with shouts and shrill whistles and barking police dogs, he felt as if he were 1,000 years old. They were formed into two lines, shivering in the raw morning air, and marched off to the quarry. The clammy dawn mist had yet to burn off, and marching through it, through a white, shadowless void with only the back of the man in front of him dimly visible, Bruckmann felt more than ever like a ghost, suspended bodiless in some limbo between heaven and earth. Only the bite of pebbles and cinders into his raw, bleeding feet kept him anchored to the world, and he clung to the pain as a lifeline, fighting to shake off a feeling of numbness and unreality. However strange, however outré, the events of the previous night had happened. To doubt it, to wonder now if it had all been a feverish dream brought on by starvation and exhaustion, was to take the first step on the road to becoming a Muslim. Wernicke is a vampire, he told himself. That was the harsh, unyielding reality that, like the reality of the camp itself, must be faced. Was it any more surreal, any more impossible than the nightmare around them? He must forget the tales that his grandmother had told him as a boy, boogie tales, as Wernicke himself had called them, half-remembered tales that turned his knees to water whenever he thought of the blood smeared on Wernicke's mouth, whenever he thought of Wernicke's eyes watching him in the dark.
"Wake up, Jew!"
The guard alongside him snarled, whacking him lightly on the arm with his rifle butt. Bruckmann stumbled, managed to stay upright and keep going. Yes, he thought, wake up. Wake up to the reality of this, just as you once had to wake up to the reality of the camp. It was just one more unpleasant fact he would have to adapt to, learn to deal with. Deal with how, he thought, and shivered. By the time they reached the quarry, the mist had burned off, swirling past them in rags and tatters, and it was already beginning to get hot. There was Wernicke, his balding head gleaming dully in the harsh morning light. He didn't dissolve in the sunlight. There was one boogie tale disproved. They set to work, like golems, like ragtag clockwork automatons. Lack of sleep had drained what small reserves of strength Bruckmann had, and the work was very hard for him that day. He had learned long ago all the tricks of timing and misdirection, the safe way to snatch short moments of rest, the ways to do a minimum of work with the maximum display of effort, the ways to keep the guards from noticing you, to fade into the faceless crowd of prisoners and not be singled out. But today, his head was muzzy and slow, and none of the tricks seemed to work. His body felt like a sheet of glass, fragile, ready to shatter into dust, and the painful, arthritic slowness of his movements got him first shouted at and then knocked down. The guard kicked him twice for good measure before he could get up. When Bruckmann had climbed back to his feet again, he saw that Wernicke was watching him, face blank, eyes expressionless, a look that could have meant anything at all. Bruckmann felt the blood trickling from the corner of his mouth and thought, the blood.
He's watching the blood. And once again he shivered. Somehow, Brookman forced himself to work faster, and although his muscles blazed with pain, he wasn't hit again, and the day passed. When they formed up to go back to camp, Brookman almost unconsciously made sure that he was in a different line than Wernicke. That night in the cabin, Brookman watched as Wernicke talked with the other men, here trying to help a new man named Melnick, no more than a boy, adjust to the dreadful reality of the camp, there exhorting someone who was slipping into despair to live and spite his tormentors, joking with old hands in the flat, black, bitter way that passed for humor among them, eliciting a wan smile, or occasionally even a laugh from them, finally leading them all in prayer again, his strong, calm voice raised in the ancient words, giving meaning to those words again. He keeps us together, Brookman thought. He keeps us going. Without him we wouldn't last a week. Surely that's worth a little blood, a bit from each man, not even enough to hurt. Surely they wouldn't even begrudge him it if they knew and really understood. No, he is a good man, better than the rest of us, in spite of his terrible affliction. Brookman had been avoiding Wernicke's eyes, hadn't spoken to him at all that day, and suddenly felt a wave of shame go through him at the thought of how shabbily he had been treating his friend. Yes, his friend, regardless, the man who had saved his life. Deliberately he caught Wernicke's eyes and nodded, and then somewhat sheepishly smiled. After a moment Wernicke smiled back, and Brookman felt a spreading warmth and relief uncoil his guts. Everything was going to be all right as it could be. Here. Nevertheless, as soon as the inside lights clicked off that night, and Brookman found himself lying alone in the darkness, his flesh began to crawl. He had been unable to keep his eyes open a moment before, but now, in the sudden darkness, he found himself tensely and tickingly awake. Where was Wernicke? What was he doing? Whom was he visiting tonight? Was he out there in the darkness even now, creeping closer, creeping nearer? "Stop it," Brookman told himself uneasily. "Forget the boogie tales. This is your friend, a good man, not a monster." But he couldn't control the fear that made the small hairs on his arms stand bristlingly erect, couldn't stop the grisly images from coming. Wernicke's eyes, gleaming in the darkness. Was the blood already glistening on Wernicke's lips as he drank? The thought of the blood staining Wernicke's yellowing teeth made Brookman cold and nauseous, but the image that he couldn't get out of his mind tonight was an image of Josef toppling over in that sinister, boneless way, striking his head against the floor. Brookman had seen people die in many more gruesome ways during this time at the camp, seen people shot, beaten to death, seen them die in convulsions from high fevers or cough their lungs up in bloody tatters from pneumonia, seen them hanging like charred black scarecrows from the electrified fences, seen them torn apart by dogs. But somehow it was Yosef's soft, passive, almost restful slumping into death that bothered him. That, and the obscene limpness of Yosef's limbs, as he sprawled there like a discarded rag doll, his pale and haggard face gleaming reproachfully in the dark. When Brookman could stand it no longer, he got shakily to his feet and moved off through the shadows, once again not knowing where he was going or what he was going to do, but drawn forward by some obscure instinct he himself did not understand. This time he went cautiously, feeling his way and trying to be silent, expecting every second to see Wernicke's coal-black shadow rise up before him. He paused, a faint noise scratching at his ears, then went on again, even more cautiously, crouching low, almost crawling across the grimy floor. Whatever instinct had guided him, sounds heard and interpreted subliminally, perhaps, it had timed his arrival well. Wernicke had someone down on the floor there, perhaps someone he seized and dragged away from the huddled mass of sleepers on one of the sleeping platforms, someone from the outer edge of bodies whose presence would not be missed, or perhaps someone who had gone to sleep on the floor seeking solitude or greater comfort. Whoever he was, he struggled in Wernicke's grip, but Wernicke handled him easily, almost negligently, in a manner that spoke of great physical power. Bruckmann could hear the man trying to scream, but Wernicke had one hand on his throat, half-throttling him, and all that would come out was a sort of whistling gasp. The man thrashed in Wernicke's hands like a kite in a child's hands flapping in the wind, and moving deliberately, Wernicke smoothed him out like a kite, pressing him slowly flat on the floor. Then Wernicke bent over him and lowered his mouth to his throat. Bruckmann watched in horror, knowing that he should shout, scream, try to rouse the other prisoners, but somehow unable to move, unable to make his mouth open, his lungs pump. He was paralyzed by fear like a rabbit in the presence of a predator, a terror sharper and more intense than any he'd ever known. The man's struggles were growing weaker, and Wernicke must have eased up some on the throttling pressure of his hand, because the man moaned,
"Don't, please, don't,"
in a weaker, slurred voice. The man had been drumming his fists against Wernicke's back and sides, but now the tempo of the drumming slowed and then stopped, the man's arms falling laxly to the floor.
"Don't,"
the man whispered. He groaned and muttered incomprehensively for a moment or two longer, then became silent. The silence stretched out for a minute, two, three, and Wernicke still crouched over his victim, who was now not moving at all. Wernicke stirred, a kind of shudder going through him like a cat stretching. He stood up. His face became visible as he straightened up into the full light from the window, and there was blood on it, glistening black under the harsh glare of the Kliegs. As Bruckmann watched, Wernicke began to lick his lips clean, his tongue also black in this light, sliding like some sort of sinuous ebony snake around the rim of his mouth, darting and probing for the last lingering drops. "How smug he looks," Bruckmann thought, "like a cat who has found the cream," and the anger that flashed through him at the thought enabled him to move and speak again.
"Wernicke!" he said harshly.
Wernicke glanced casually in his direction.
"You again, Isidore," Wernicke said. "Don't you ever sleep?"
Wernicke spoke lazily, quizzically, without surprise, and Bruckmann wondered if Wernicke had known all along that he was there.
"Or do you just enjoy watching me?"
"Lies," Bruckmann said. "You told me nothing but lies. Why did you bother?"
"You were excited," Wernicke said. "You had surprised me. It seemed best to tell you what you wanted to hear. If it satisfied you, then that was an easy solution to the problem."
"Never have I drained a lie from someone who wanted to live," Bruckmann said bitterly, mimicking Wernicke. "Only a little from each man. My God! And I believed you. I even felt sorry for you."
Wernicke shrugged.
"Most of it was true. Usually I only take a little from each man, softly and carefully, so that they never know, so that in the morning they are only a little weaker than they would have been anyway."
"Like Joseph?" Bruckmann said angrily. "Like the poor devil you killed tonight?"
Wernicke shrugged again.
"I have been careless the last few nights, I admit, but I need to build up my strength again."
His eyes gleamed in the darkness.
"Events are coming to a head here. Can't you feel it, Isidore? Can't you sense it? Soon the war will be over. Everyone knows that. Before then, this camp will be shut down, and the Nazis will move us back into the interior. Either that or kill us. I have grown weak here, and I will soon need all my strength to survive, to take whatever opportunity presents itself to escape. I must be ready, and so I have let myself drink deeply again, drink my fill for the first time in months.
Wernicke licked his lips again, perhaps unconsciously, then smiled bleakly at Bruckmann.
You don't appreciate my restraint, Isidore. You don't understand how hard it has been for me to hold back, to take only a little each night. You don't understand how much that restraint has cost me.
You are gracious, Bruckmann sneered.
Wernicke laughed.
No, but I am a rational man. I pride myself on that. You other prisoners were my only source of food, and I have had to be very careful to make sure that you would last. I have no access to the Nazis, after all. I am trapped here, a prisoner just like you, whatever else you may believe. And I have not only had to find ways to survive here in the camp, I have had to procure my own food as well. No shepherd has ever watched over his flock more tenderly than I.
Is that all we are to you? Sheep? Animals to be slaughtered?
Wernicke smiled.
Precisely.
When he could control his voice enough to speak, Bruckmann said,
You're worse than the Nazis.
I hardly think so,
Wernicke said quietly, and for a moment he looked tired, as though something unimaginably old and unutterably weary had looked out through his eyes.
This camp was built by the Nazis. It wasn't my doing. The Nazis sent you here, not I. The Nazis have tried to kill you every day since, in one way or another, and I have tried to keep you alive, even at some risk to myself. No one has more of a vested interest in the survival of his livestock than the farmer, after all, even if he does occasionally slaughter an inferior animal. I have given you food.
Food you had no use for yourself. You sacrificed nothing.
That's true, of course, but you needed it. Remember that. Whatever my motives, I have helped you to survive here, you and many others. By doing so, I also acted in my own self-interest, of course, but can you have experienced this camp and still believe in things like altruism? What difference does it make what my reason for helping was? I still helped you, didn't I?
Sophistries, Bruckmann said.
Rationalizations. You twist words to justify yourself, but you can't disguise what you really are. A monster.
Wernicke smiled gently, as though Bruckmann's words amused him, and made as if to pass by, but Bruckmann raised an arm to bar his way. They did not touch each other, but Wernicke stopped short, and a new quivering kind of tension sprung into existence in the air between them.
"I'll stop you," Bruckmann said. "Somehow I'll stop you. I'll keep you from doing this terrible thing."
"You'll do nothing,"
Wernicke said. His voice was hard and cold and flat, like a rock speaking.
"What can you do? Tell the other prisoners? Who would believe you? They'd think you'd gone insane. Tell the Nazis, then?"
Wernicke laughed harshly.
"They'd think you'd gone crazy, too, and they'd take you to the hospital, and I don't have to tell you what your chances of getting out of there alive are, do I?" "No, you'll do nothing."
Wernicke took a step forward. His eyes were shiny and black and hard like ice, like the pitiless eyes of a predatory bird, and Bruckmann felt a sick rush of fear cut through his anger. Bruckmann gave way, stepping backward involuntarily, and Wernicke pushed past him, seeming to brush him aside without touching him. Once past, Wernicke turned to stare at Bruckmann, and Bruckmann had to summon up all the defiance that remained in him, not to look uneasily away from Wernicke's agate hard eyes.
"You are the strongest and cleverest of all the other animals, Isidore," Wernicke said in a calm, conversational voice. "You have been useful to me. Every shepherd needs a good sheepdog. I still need you to help me manage the others, and to help me keep them going long enough to serve my needs. This is the reason why I have taken so much time with you, instead of just killing you outright."
He shrugged.
"So, let us both be rational about this. You leave me alone, Isidore, and I will leave you alone also. We will stay away from each other and look after our own affairs. Yes?"
"The others,"
Bruckmann said weakly.
"They must look after themselves," Wernicke said.
He smiled, a thin and almost invisible motion of his lips.
"What did I teach you, Isidore? Here everyone must look after themselves. What difference does it make what happens to the others? In a few weeks, almost all of them will be dead anyway."
"You are a monster,"
Bruckmann said.
"I'm not much different from you, Isidore. The strong survive, whatever the cost."
"I am nothing like you,"
Bruckmann said with loathing.
"No?"
Wernicke asked ironically and moved away. Within a few paces he was hobbling and stooping, vanishing into the shadows once more, the harmless old Jew. Bruckmann stood motionless for a moment, and then, moving slowly and reluctantly, he stepped across to where Wernicke's victim lay. It was one of the new men Wernicke had been talking to earlier in the evening, and, of course, he was quite dead. Shame and guilt took Bruckmann then, emotions he thought he had forgotten, black and strong and bitter. They shook him by the throat, the way Wernicke had shaken the new man. Bruckmann couldn't remember returning across the room to his sleeping platform, but suddenly he was there, lying on his back and staring into the stifling darkness, surrounded by the moaning, thrashing, stinking mass of sleepers. His hands were clasped protectively over his throat, although he couldn't remember putting them there, and he was shivering convulsively. How many mornings had he awoken with a dull ache in his neck, thinking it was no more than the habitual body aches and strained muscles they had all learned to take for granted? How many nights had Wernicke fed on him? Every time Bruckmann closed his eyes, he would see Wernicke's face floating there in the luminous darkness behind his eyelids. Wernicke, with his eyes half closed, his face vulpine and cruel and satiated. Wernicke's face moving closer and closer to him, his eyes opening like black pits, his lips smiling back from his teeth. Wernicke's lips sticky and red with blood. And then Bruckmann would seem to feel the wet touch of Wernicke's lips on his throat, feel Wernicke's teeth biting into his flesh, and Bruckmann's eyes would fly open again. Staring into the darkness. Nothing there. Nothing there yet. Dawn was a dirty gray imminence against the cabin window before Bruckmann could force himself to lower his shielding arms from his throat, and once again he had not slept at all. That day's work was a nightmare of pain and exhaustion for Bruckmann, harder than anything he had known since his first few days at the camp. Somehow he forced himself to get up. Somehow he stumbled outside and up the path to the quarry, seeming to float along high off the ground, his head a bloated balloon, his feet 1,000 miles away at the end of boneless beanstalk legs he could barely control at all. Twice he fell and was kicked several times before he could drag himself back to his feet and lurch forward again. The sun was coming up in front of them, a hard red disk in a sickly yellow sky. And to Brookman it seemed to be a glazed and lidless eye staring dispassionately into the world, to watch them flail and struggle and die, like the eye of a scientist peering into a laboratory maze. He watched the disk of the sun as he stumbled towards it. It seemed to bob and shimmer with every painful step, expanding, swelling, and bloating until it swallowed the sky. Then he was picking up a rock, moaning with the effort, feeling the rough stone tear his hands. Reality began to slide away from Brookman. There were long periods when the world was blank, and he would come slowly back to himself, as if from a great distance, and hear his own voice speaking words that he could not understand, or keening mindlessly, or grunting in a hoarse, animalistic way, and he would find that his body was working mechanically, stooping and lifting and carrying, all without volition. A Musulman, Brookman thought, I'm becoming a Musulman, and felt a chill of fear sweep through him. He fought to hold on to the world, afraid that the next time he slipped away from himself, he would not come back. Deliberately banging his hands into the rocks, cutting himself, clearing his head with pain. The world steadied around him. A guard shouted a hoarse admonishment at him and slapped his rifle butt, and Brookman forced himself to work faster, although he could not keep himself from weeping silently with the pain his movements cost him. He discovered that Wernicke was watching him, and stared back defiantly, the bitter tears still runneling his dirty cheeks, thinking, I won't become a Musulman for you. I won't make it easy for you. I won't provide another helpless victim for you. Wernicke met Brookman's gaze for a moment, and then shrugged and turned away. Brookman bent for another stone, feeling the muscles in his back crack and the pain drive in like knives. What had Wernicke been thinking behind the blankness of his expressionless face? Had Wernicke, sensing weakness, marked Brookman for his next victim? Had Wernicke been disappointed or dismayed by the strength of Brookman's will to survive? Would Wernicke now settle upon someone else? The morning passed, and Brookman grew feverish again. He could feel the fever in his face, making his eyes feel sandy and hot, pulling the skin taut over his cheekbones, and he wondered how long he could manage to stay on his feet. To falter, to grow weak and insensible, was certain death. If the Nazis didn't kill him, Wernicke would. Wernicke was out of sight now, on the other side of the quarry, but it seemed to Brookman that Wernicke's hard and flinty eyes were everywhere, floating in the air around him, looking out momentarily from the back of a Nazi soldier's head, watching him from the dulled iron side of a quarry cart, peering at him from a dozen different angles. He bent ponderously for another rock, and when he had pried it up from the earth, he found Wernicke's eyes beneath it, staring unblinkingly up at him from the damp and pallid soil. That afternoon there were great flashes of light on the eastern horizon, out across the endless flat expanse of the steppe, flares in rapid sequence that lit up the sullen gray sky, all without sound. The Nazi guards had gathered in a group, looking to the east and talking in subdued voices, ignoring the prisoners for the moment. For the first time, Brookman noticed how disheveled and unshaven the guards had become in the last few days, as though they had given up, as though they no longer cared. Their faces were strained and tight, and more than one of them seemed to be fascinated by the leaping fires on the distant edge of the world. Melnik said that it was only a thunderstorm, but old Boma said that it was an artillery battle being fought, and that that meant that the Russians were coming, that soon they would all be liberated. Boma grew so excited at the thought that he began shouting, "The Russians! It's the Russians! The Russians are coming to free us!" Dick Stein, another one of the new prisoners, and Melnick tried to hush him, but Boma continued to caper and shout, doing a grotesque kind of jig while he yelled and flapped his arms, until he had attracted the attention of the guards. Infuriated, two of the guards fell upon Boma and beat him severely, striking him with their rifle butts with more than usual force, knocking him to the ground, continuing to flail at him and kick him while he was down, Boma writhing like an injured worm under their stamping boots. They probably would have beaten Boma to death on the spot, but Wernicke organized a distraction among some of the other prisoners, and when the guards moved away to deal with it, Wernicke helped Boma to stand up and hobble away to the other side of the quarry, where the rest of the prisoners shielded him from sight with their bodies as best they could for the rest of the afternoon. Something about the way Wernicke urged Boma to his feet and helped him to limp and lurch away, something about the protective, possessive curve of Wernicke's arm around Boma's shoulders, told Bruckmann that Wernicke had selected his next victim. That night, Bruckmann vomited up the meager and rancid meal that they were allowed, his stomach convulsing uncontrollably after the first few bites. Trembling with hunger and exhaustion and fever, he leaned against the wall and watched as Wernicke fussed over Boma, nursing him as a man might nurse a sick child, talking gently to him, wiping away some of the blood that still oozed from the corner of Boma's mouth, coaxing Boma to drink a few sips of soup, finally arranging that Boma should stretch out on the floor away from the sleeping platforms, where he would not be jostled by the others. As soon as the interior lights went out that night, Bruckmann got up, crossed the floor quickly and unhesitantly, and lay down in the shadows near the spot where Boma muttered and twitched and groaned. Shivering, Bruckmann lay in the darkness, the strong smell of the earth in his nostrils, waiting for Wernicke to come. In Bruckmann's hand, held close to his chest, was a spoon that had been sharpened to a jagged needle point, a spoon he had stolen and begun to sharpen while he was still in a civilian prison in Cologne, so long ago that he almost couldn't remember, scraping it back and forth against the stone wall of his cell every night for hours, managing to keep it hidden on his person during the nightmarish ride in the sweltering boxcar the first few terrible days at the camp, telling no one about it, not even Wernicke, during the months when he'd thought of Wernicke as a kind of saint, keeping it hidden long after the possibility of escape had become too remote even to fantasize about, retaining it then more as a tangible link with the daydream country of his past than as a tool he ever actually hoped to employ, cherishing it almost as a holy relic, as a remnant of a vanished world that he otherwise might almost believe had never existed at all. And now that it was time to use it at last, he was almost reluctant to do so, to soil it with another man's blood. He fingered the spoon compulsively, turning it over and over. It was hard and smooth and cold, and he clenched it as tightly as he could, trying to ignore the fine tremoring of his hands. He had to kill Wernicke. Nausea and an odd feeling of panic flashed through Bruckmann at the thought, but there was no other choice, there was no other way. He couldn't go on like this. His strength was failing. Wernicke was killing him as surely as he had killed the others, just by keeping him from sleeping. And as long as Wernicke lived, he would never be safe. Always there would be the chance that Wernicke would come for him, that Wernicke would strike as soon as his guard was down. Would Wernicke scruple for a second to kill him, after all, if he thought that he could do it safely? No, of course not. Given the chance, Wernicke would kill him without a moment's further thought. No, he must strike first. Bruckmann licked his lips uneasily. Tonight. He had to kill Wernicke. Tonight. There was a stirring, a rustling. Someone was getting up, working his way free from the mass of sleepers on one of the platforms. A shadowy figure crossed the room toward Bruckmann, And Brookman tensed, reflexively running his thumb along the jagged end of the spoon, readying himself to rise, to strike. But at the last second, the figure veered aside and stumbled toward another corner. There was a sound like rain drumming on cloth. The man swayed there for a moment, mumbling, and then slowly returned to his pallet, dragging his feet, as if he had pissed his very life away against the wall. It was not Wernicke. Brookman eased himself back down to the floor, his heart seeming to shake his wasted body back and forth with the force of its beating. His hand was damp with sweat. He wiped it against his tattered pants, and then clutched the spoon again. Time seemed to stop. Brookman waited, stretched out along the hard floorboards, the raw wood rasping his skin, dust clogging his mouth and nose, feeling as though he were already dead, a corpse laid out in the rough pine coffin, feeling eternity pile up on his chest like heavy clots of wet black earth. Outside the hut, the Kleegs blazed, banishing night, abolishing it. But here inside the hut it was night. Here night survived, perhaps the only pocket of night remaining on a Kleeg-lit planet. The shafts of light that came in through the slatted windows